Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey y'all, welcome back to the Thursday, May 26th, 2022 edition here on the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. Jam-packed show for you guys today, three-parter here on the Chase Thomas Podcast. So very excited to drop all those on your podcast feed today. So look out for all three coming on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Make sure you check out all three if you can. But first up, we got Connor O'Gara of Saturday Down South to talk all things SEC, college football, the future of college football, NIL, Jimbo versus Nick, Kentucky, the SEC East, Tennessee, all that and more with Connor. Great conversation that I think you guys will enjoy. So that's what we're doing to get started here on part one of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Make sure that you check us out on YouTube. We're on YouTube, youtube.com, type in the Chase Thomas Podcast. You'll find us there. Read me at sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com. Type in your email. That simple, that easy. Write about hype and the hype train for the Tennessee Volunteers in terms of Vegas betting odds heading into the 2022 season. So check that out at sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com. Type in your email and become a subscriber today so you never miss any of my future stuff. Tweet at me at @Chase_Thomas. Like the Facebook page at facebook.com/ChaseThomasWriter. And then email the program at ChaseThomasPodcast@gmail.com. All right, Uncle Darren, let's go.
Chase Thomas Podcast. The Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I am joined by one of my favorite college football SEC minds. It's Connor O'Gara of Saturday Down South, a very good, very great SEC coverage site. Connor, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hey, appreciate it, man. Good to be here. It feels like in the middle of May, we've had some pretty incredible fireworks, which, look, I'm in the content business. I don't hate that one bit. So, yeah, there's probably about a million different things to be able to talk about right now.
How over just the NIL? Like, what is the biggest thing that you get from fans that tweet at you or email you guys that just you're like, all right, I want to move on. I want to move on from this subject matter because there's just I'm tired of talking about it. Is there one thing?
I get tired of talking about like what it means for the future of the sport and if it's going to kill college football. Mm. Like, I can't think of a single time during a college football Saturday this past year in which I thought to myself, man, you know what? NIL just made that Saturday worse. Like, mm-hmm. I never had that thought. And so for everybody that continues to say that and to default to it or to use it as like something in the off season where anytime they see a ridiculous headline, you know, certain Tennessee commit, maybe get $8
million. Hold on, Connor. We are a minute and a half in. You don't have to go there. You don't know. Sports out of this.
I'm admitting that I do not know the financials of that. And, you know, based on the people that I've talked to, it's kind of been understood. But at the same time, I'm also not the person sitting here being like, it's going to kill the sport. It's going to be so much worse. Or I hate it when people say, you'll get responses about like, oh, you know, they're going to have to do taxes on that. It's like, yeah. You know what? Like, Americans have to do is taxes when they make money. Mm-hmm. Like that's the way income tax works. So yeah, it's one of those things that I feel like people that are from a different era of college football, I grew up in a different era of college football, have had a tougher time dealing with. I'm more of the mindset of like, I don't want to see a cap. I think market value is really relative and all over the place at this point, but you know, I think it was something that was long overdue, and you can't have these TV contracts without players at least being able to get some sort of a cut from the name, image, and likeness.
Yeah, and you're not getting the cap. Like, your antitrust lawsuits are coming. Like, you cannot do any of that. But you talk about the market value. It's just kind of, I think when you talk to coaches, and talked to a lot of coaches, and both the high school and college level, and it just seems like it's, and this is, I think, kind of what Saban's speaking to a little bit, is that once you're here and you're playing on Saturdays in Tuscaloosa, your value goes significantly up. Like, people are watching Alabama because they're like, oh, Bryce Young's fun. Like, Will Anderson on the edge is fun. People are wearing your jerseys all around the stadium. People are coming to see you play. But when you're coming in, these high school kids, like a junior or senior, where there is no, there shouldn't really be much of a market value, right? Because we don't know, and most people don't know who you are yet. But you are, it's not really market value is what they're arguing when they're juniors and seniors in high school. So it's like when people are like, oh, it's just the market working. It's like, this is kind of a different kind of market, because these boosters and different schools are kind of creating their own little markets for these guys. And that kind of complicates and makes everything ambiguous. But speaking to what else you've been saying about the death of college football, it's always been murky. It's always been gray. This sport has been defined by its gray nature for my entire life. It's always been gray. It's just different levels now, and it's just getting used to more gray and more uncertainty, and I think just a lot more work for fans. Like, that I think is unmistakable, is that if you want to be a big time college football fan in 2022, it is significantly harder than it was 10 years ago. Like, it is so much harder to know who's where, who's in what division, who's in what conference, how everything works, like what this guy is going to do, like where we are in the portal, where we are with NIL. Like, there's just so much more that we're asking the average college football fan to keep up with. And I think that is something that will continue to hurt the sport going forward, is that fans cannot invest the same way, because they're like, I don't even know who's who anymore. Like, even in my division, I don't know who's under. Like, if you ask the average SEC fan right now, could they tell you who Missouri's quarterback is going into this year?
I couldn't tell you, because there I don't know if it's going to be Brady Cook or yeah. if it's going to be Tyler Macon. I know they tried to get into the portal. They got Jack Abraham, the kid who was originally in Southern Miss, and then he went to Mississippi State. Yeah. And I thought that – I thought Eli Drinkwitz should have made a play for JT Daniels. That was even stronger. I know that, that was in the mix. But I think that's going to quietly be one of the storylines that Mizzou wonders about this year, because somebody like Luther Burden – so this is a good example of this. Mm. Luther Burden comes in as number one overall – receiver in the country, and he goes to Mizzou. He's an East St. Louis kid, and now in this era of the transfer portal, you're like, wait a minute, Eli Drinkwitz needs to figure out his quarterback situation. Didn't work with Connor Bazelak. He transferred to my alma mater, Indiana, and now we're kind of wondering, like, all right, so like, what's Mizzou gonna do at quarterback? And if they don't figure that out, could Luther Burden leave after year one? Because you know that dude's gonna get tampered with. You got everybody and their mother saying, hey, come here, play for this guy, team up with this quarterback. So like, those are the moving pieces that you talk about, that, you know, even 3 years ago, we're not having that conversation about a number one receiver recruit, because it's like, all right, well, if he's going to transfer as an undergrad, then he's going to at least have to sit for a year or something like that. So it's messy. It's murky. It's just a sport that has more moving pieces than ever right now.
Yeah. What do you think? What are you hearing? What do you think gets figured out first? What do you think? Because it's not the NCAA that figures this out. What do you think Sankey and the rest of the ADs and commissioners figure out first? What do you think? And it could be NIL, it could be portal, it could be roster movement. What do you think they figure out first?
I think they figure out a plan to break away from the NCAA. I think that's That's like the non-move move. But they've realized going through the pandemic and dealing with scheduling issues and whatnot that the Power Five commissioners have all the power. I mean, that's really what this comes down to. I don't see them all of a sudden settling on a cap. I know that George Kliarkov, the Pac-12 commissioner, I know Greg Sankey, they went to Washington to be able to sit down with those decision makers and say, hey, we need federal legislation on this stuff. I think more likely than running into a bunch of antitrust lawsuits is just breaking away from the NCAA and coming up with your own enforcement entity. Because right now, what good does the NCAA do for college football if it's not going to be an enforcement agency? I mean, you have blatant cases of tampering. The NCAA has tampering rules, and they just choose not to enforce them. This is the same organization. I've repeated this point a lot, so I'm not saying this for the first time, but this is the same organization that literally said it was overwhelmed by the waiver wire process in the transfer portal system that it created, and therefore did away with that and allowed undergrads to be able to transfer without having to sit out a year. So, like, this is an organization that with college football, like, college football has just gotten too big for the NCAA. It's as simple as that. So I think that's kind of next, and that's what's going to allow college football to ultimately transfer into a real true pay for play era, and not this kind of weird space that we're in right now where we don't know what's pay for play, what's NIL, and anything can kind of be summed up as NIL. And I think we'll have some more defined guidelines in the latter half of the decade.
Yeah. Jack Swarbrick's interview with Pat Forty was extremely illuminating a few weeks back. It just makes me nervous in some areas where it's just like you said. I think the best way to describe it is it's too big now. Like, it's just too big, and this is just what happens when you become a billion-dollar industry, and that you just have this many moving parts, this many people that need to be paid, this many just circumstances involved. I just wonder, do you think, like, when I just had Edgar Thompson on from the Orlando Sentinel, and we were talking about Florida, but he was also talking about, he talked to Scott Strickland, the AD at Florida, not too long ago, for a story. And something that he brought up was just that, I asked him, I was like, do you think the posturing is going to, like, he described it as posturing if the SEC is going to have their own playoff. But the one thing he was like, divisions are gone, like, that from the sense that when we get to 16 teams in the SEC, divisions are out. And it seems like the ACC is already doing that. The Big Ten's going to do that. Like, that's where we don't need divisions anymore. But when I saw, oh, there's some, like, we'll just do our own college football playoff, we'll just do that, that scares me, where it's like, okay, then we're just going into way too much tribalism in our camps, and that's not what anybody wants. I don't even think players want that. That's not fun for America. That's not fun for the sport. And I was like, that's posturing. Like, he was like, that's posturing. I don't think they're actually going to do that, but it's more of like, this is our power, and we will do this if you don't expand the playoff or do what we want to do going forward. It's more, do you think that's more where they're at?
It's leverage, 100%. Mm-hmm. It's Greg Sankey saying, I really hated the way that this played out, where all of a sudden the Alliance decides, oh, you know what? Actually, we don't want to do this expansion to 12 teams, and we're really hung up on the automatic qualifiers for the Power Five Conference champs, having that automatic qualifier for the highest rated Group of Five champ, having that special time slot for the Rose Bowl. You know what? We as the Alliance, we don't want to support this expansion movement. And Sankey's like, look, I was the one that was trying to get down on your level. I'm the one that has the conference that's out here dominating, that's 12-3 in college football playoff games, excluding the ones that are SEC against SEC. So we're talking about a dynamic here, the SEC versus everyone else, that exists. Because I don't think the Big 12 is really factoring into this at all with how in flux it is losing Texas and Oklahoma. And I think that Greg Sankey's, and he has been very vocal about this ever since they had that meeting back in January, had the national championship. He said, I feel like people took me seriously when I said we don't have to expand. They don't have to expand when the current contract runs out at the end of the 2025 season. That's kind of the misconception. So, oh, well, you know, if we don't do it early, then, you know, we'll still get there in 2026. And to me, I look at everything Greg Sankey has said, and he's like, look, man, we don't need this. We're going to have 16 teams in our league, and winning this conference is going to be an unbelievable achievement. We'll get the TV contracts. We know that SEC fans will watch people playing rock, paper, scissors. They'll watch anything. So that's the part of it. I agree with you, though. I hate that idea. I think it takes us back into the 20th century. And yeah. I don't want to see in 1997 where in Nebraska and Michigan don't actually play for a national championship. Picture if that played out this year, where you have Alabama going 13-0. They win the SEC championship, whatever the regular season SEC championship is. I guess that'd be different if you had an all-SEC playoff. And then Ohio State wins, you know, goes 13-0 and then wins this non-SEC playoff. And then those two teams don't play? What?
Yeah.
I don't want that. I don't think even the most diehard SEC fan wants that, even though they'll probably say, oh yeah, let's break off, let's do our own thing. It's all about leverage. Greg Sankey wants to be able to get the alliance to realize, look, these are stupid things to get hung up on. We have two decades worth of data to show us that not all conferences are created equal. Why should it be the same prize for the Pac-12 to be able to have their conference champ get the same exact thing that the SEC champ does? That just doesn't make any sense. And I understand why Greg Sankey made this move, though I agree with you, that's not what he wants to see happen from this situation.
What do you think ultimately happens? Do you think we get to 12 in a couple of years? What do you think ultimately happens here?
And I'm beginning to think that we could stay at 4. Like, I think that's possible. And the interesting thing here, and I don't know how much this has really been talked about, but it should be, when so Oklahoma and Texas coming to the SEC, that initially looked imminent. We're like, what is the Big 12 going to do? Have these lame duck powerhouse teams in their conference and just awkwardly have to hand Oklahoma a Big 12 championship trophy for 3 years? Now it's looking that like that's going to play out, and they're going to have this weird scheduling model for 2 years, because don't forget, like, in addition to, you know, UCF, Houston, and Cincinnati going to the Big 12 next year, BYU is also going to the Big 12.
Right.
So there's not necessarily this urgency, though, on the SEC side to add Texas and Oklahoma. That deal is done. It's happening. It's not like the playoff where we're like, oh, will it happen? Won't it happen? No. Oklahoma and Texas are going to be in the SEC for the start of the 2025 season. So if you're Greg Sankey, you don't have to worry about that. They're coming. It's just a matter of time. Why would you want to necessarily get them in there early for a 4-team playoff and have a 16-team conference and then potentially box yourself out even more? The SEC has always been so smart in terms of the way that it creates its path to the playoff. I thought the Big Ten really cannibalized itself when it made that move, going from the 8-game conference schedule to the 9-game conference schedule. And they did that in 2016. They watched their conference champion get left out of the college football playoff 3 years in a row. That's bad. The SEC doesn't have that problem. The champion of the SEC has played in a national championship game 15 of the last 16 years. So that's not the issue there. But at the same time, there's a balance. And that's what the SEC is trying to figure out. That's what they're trying to figure out with the scheduling model and all these things. So that's a long-winded way of answering. There are a lot of moving pieces here, but I don't necessarily think it's a lock that we expand. And I think there's a scenario in which it stays at 4 and the SEC decides if it wants to break off. But maybe that does mean, like, hey, you know, the SEC kind of has to give in here and it doesn't ultimately get its way.
That's interesting. I'm excited to see how that goes. I don't know if you're with me on this, but where I'm at is I love bowl season. I grew up loving bowl season. Bowl season's dead. I'm okay with moving on at this point with the playoff. It's like, if the playoff is going to be kind of like our March Madness, where everything revolves around the college football playoff and the conversations week to week, and these universities are making hiring and firing decisions on the college football playoff, and players are deciding what to do with their winter time based on the college football playoff and where they're at, we might as well just rip the band-aid off and just say, all right, the sport is now the FCS. This is where we're at. We're doing the playoff system. That's it. We love bowl season, but it's just like the BCS. It's a thing of the past. We got to move on. 12 teams, whatever. Great season. I don't know. I wonder where it goes, because, man, there's no point in having, like, you talk about people getting left out of the playoff. It's just more like, I wonder if there's like this tough medicine that Greg Sankey has to explain to a lot of these ADs around the country. Because what I've always argued is, like, Cincinnati was a great story last year. Like, they were cool. That was a great story. They gave Alabama a...
Can we argue about Cincinnati?
Okay, go ahead.
So I was on the Cincinnati bandwagon, like,
yeah,
very early. I said in May last year, they're going to the college football playoff. I was on record with that. Let's ignore the fact that I had Clemson winning a national championship, that I said it was going to be the best Oklahoma team of the Lincoln Riley era. That stuff's irrelevant.
Yeah, but I'll scratch it from the record. I'll cut that.
Yeah, we don't need that part. Mm-hmm. But I thought Cincinnati deserved it and mm-hmm. was plenty worthy of that. And you see the way that it played out in the NFL draft where you're looking up and down. You're like, dang, like, so they had an early round NFL quarterback. They had more guys getting drafted than the vast majority of college football
Look,
teams.
I've always been a Desmond Ridder guy. People forget. Yep. I've always been all in on Desmond Ridder. Always been in on Look, a guy who's like 22 who looks 47. I've always been in on him. Yeah.
Yeah. Have we ever seen Desmond Ridder and Kane Brown in the same place? I always ask that question.
They're, I don't know.
They look really, really similar. Mm-hmm. I wonder about that. Although after Kane Brown's appearance on College Game Day, I'm not convinced that he knows his way around the football field, but that's a different story for a different time. I think that Cincinnati was worthy. Like, I have no problem with Cincinnati doing what it did, which was going to Notre Dame and winning that game, mm-hmm. and then going to Indiana and beating my alma mater, who had a really disappointing season. But I thought, like, all right, if you're going to be a Group of Five team, it's not just within that season. What Cincinnati did to actually give itself a chance was play a game that went down to the wire against Georgia, a team that was really hot coming in. So, like, I know we talked a lot last year about, like, what Group of Five teams were kind of worthy and would Cincinnati be able to kind of stack up. And I actually, like, it played out exactly the way that I thought it would against Alabama. Like, that's pretty par for the course with their game plan. So I had no problem whatsoever with Cincinnati getting in, though admittedly I was biased with having that pick back.
Houston's got, I don't know if you looked at Houston's schedule and their return. Houston, I said on this podcast, I was like, folks, do not be surprised if Houston's 11-0, 10-0 late in the season. And people are like, are they going to backdoor their way? Are we going to get backdoor AAC teams back-to-back years? I just don't think, like, a lot had to go right. Like, if Oklahoma State does not get stuffed at the goal line, Cincinnati does not make the playoff, I don't think. So a lot had to go right. And I don't think anyone, even, I don't know if Cincinnati would even argue that they were a better team than Oklahoma State last year.
They would argue they were better.
Would you?
Than State. They would. I wouldn't. I
feel so bad for the Cowboys. Like, that was their moment. Like, that was it. They finally broke through and just stuffed on the goal line. Because that Baylor team was fun story, but Oklahoma State was just pulverizing people. That defense was legit. They had all these guys coming back for the extra COVID year. And it was just the stars aligned. Oklahoma had the season from hell. Texas had the season from hell. It's like, everything's coming up, Cowboy. And then to not do that, and then, because I think they also would have given Alabama a better game. I think that would have been more of a problem.
I mean, the game itself was just kind of a grind game.
Yeah.
Like, that was going to be the game plan. There was no way, like, if you're Alabama, why would you test Sauce Gardner and Kobe Bryant in this unbelievable secondary? Why would you let MyJ Sanders get ahead of steam? Like, that defense was just so good, and it kind of made sense to kind of grind them down the way that they did. But yeah, like, I last year, the way that played out, you know, getting into that fourth spot, it's like, yeah, all these different things could have happened, but, you know, at the same time, do I think any one of those teams would have beaten Alabama? No. Like, I don't know that Oklahoma State would have. I mean, Oklahoma State did not have the
offense. Well, there's more to it than that, right? It's not just beating Alabama with a 14 playoff, and that was something I pitch to the Cincinnati argument, was just that, like, it's not just beating Alabama, then you're having to beat Georgia, a Group of Five. Like, it's just, college football is not like the NFL like that, where you can expect a Group of Five school to run the gauntlet of the top two SEC teams. They're not beating them in back, like, it's just, well, not.
What about Oklahoma? Can we expect Oklahoma to do that? No. Like, that's the thing, is these teams that have happened in the semifinal, where it's just like, it's so obvious, man. Like,
right,
college football is different in that regard. And then what I keep preaching over and over again is, talent wins in college football. Mm-hmm. Look at the 247 talent composite index year after year after year, and you will see the correlation. There's a reason why these teams, when they have a month to prepare, they got a month to prepare, the most talented team wins, like, every single time. And it's not as simple as saying, well, you know, if they had been Power Five, they would have had a better chance. Like, Oklahoma State was, I don't even think they were in the top 40 in the talent composite. Like, I don't think they would have been able to give Alabama a much better game. I'm really intrigued about, you know, Jim Knowles going to Ohio State and how that could potentially impact that defense, because they need some help. And Ohio State is, like, I came out this week with my playoff predictions. I have Ohio State winning a national championship, and that being kind of a difference maker. Yeah. Oh, do you want me to drop a stat on you?
I'm ready.
Okay. I'll just ask you this question. I floated this out on the Saturday Night South podcast as well. In the past 17 years, how many times do you think the AP preseason number one has gone on to win a national championship?
Not opt. Is it zero?
It's one.
One? Who was it?
2017 Bama, a team that Ooh. Many people said shouldn't have been in the playoff. They needed overtime. They needed second 26, all these different things. So, like, I wonder about that dynamic, about this year's Alabama team and how hearing 8 months of how good you are and getting that kind of scrutiny, how that impacts a team. And I do wonder, you know, I guess if there's anybody that can kind of overcome that, it's Bryce Young. I
mean, right.
He's kind of wired that way. But I do wonder about a stat like that. And I think that, like, when people hear that, they're like, wait a minute. So we're just wrong about Alabama all the time. It feels like we just blindly pencil Alabama in and it never quite happens. But I think we end up getting an Alabama-Ohio State national championship.
See, that would even surprise me. Like, that would be three straight national title appearances for Bama. It's a lot of mileage on a lot of those guys who've been with that team. But I don't know. We could see it. I just have more questions, I guess, in years past. We'll see how, if Burton is the guy and he just lights it up. I don't know. We'll see with Bama. I think they'll be fine. They've got a good coach down there in Tuscaloosa, I've heard. I think they'll be okay. Speaking of that, do you think – this is something I was thinking about with Jimbo and Nick, was that – people were like, oh, is it October 8th yet? Is it October 8th yet? I'm ready for this game. First off, folks, don't wish your life away. This is silly. When I see stuff like that, it bums me out where I'm like, you guys got to fill your Wednesdays and your Thursdays in mid-May. You gotta live day by day, day by day. Let's not, the college football fans are like, I'm ready for the season. No. Let's watch the number one team in baseball. It's a lot of fun. Just take it day by day. Like being in everything school. Just one of those cool things about being a volunteer. It's just that you have good sports year round. It's a fun thing. Like you being an IU guy, it's not really
soccer,
a thing for you.
Little 500 is a lot of fun.
There you go.
A lot of cycling. Women's basketball had a really, really good year. And like men's basketball was, you know, for
what's it looks like
the 21st century.
Yeah, they're moving.
Trace Jackson Davis coming back, you know, big news. But yeah, I'm not holding my breath on that.
We'll see. But I guess it's just a lot can change with Jimbo and Nick. I feel like this summer, I would not be surprised at all if the animus between the two of them is gone and faded into the background by October 8th. Am I wrong there that I think these guys will talk it out? And it was just more of like a heat of the moment. He was super mad. He went nuclear publicly. And then Saban, I have a hard time believing these guys who all have lake houses next to each other and they all seemingly are friends behind the scenes will not work this out. Like, I have a hard time believing that it's more of like a competition where it's like the stakes are so high. And I think the nerves of a lot of these guys are so fried that they're going to have some time away or they're going to go to the lake and then play some golf and be like, what were we arguing about? What were we like? What did I really go after you publicly in that way? Did I call you despicable 19 times? And I don't know. I feel like Nick Saban might even have a sense of humor about it, where it's like, that was pretty good. That was a good rant, Jimbo. I don't know. Am I wrong?
This felt different. You know, it just felt a little bit different. You're right in that these guys fraternize in ways that we probably don't fully understand. When we're all opening our Phil Steele magazine in the summer. Nick Saban and Dabo Sweeney are on Gasparilla Island hanging out together and they're debating who owes each other dinner. Like that's the way that plays out. And it could play out in very anticlimactic fashion with Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban. But this felt personal. It really did. For Jimbo to stand up there and not just say, hey, we didn't buy our recruiting class. And that's the key word in this entire deal is Saban saying bought. A&M bought its entire recruiting class. And like you can debate the merits of that. I'll just sit here today and say there's no way that Nick Saban could have known for certain that every single member of A&M was only, you know, was strictly bought and that A&M was the highest bidder in all this and like that they signed specific contracts. Like there's just no way that Saban can know.
And the idea that Walter Nolan didn't just watch tape of Miles Garrett and then him, A&M being like, here's what we do with defensive linemen at College Station. Like, you're in good hands. Like Miles Garrett could have reached out to Walter Nolan and that could have been something like that where it's just, I understand where he's like, no, there's recruiting that goes into this. There's still, you have to be good. If it was easy and if it was just bought, like everybody would do it. And his perspective is like, no, we're still putting in the time. Like tell my guys who are at these high schools flying around all the time, meeting with these kids, showing them tape. Cause they showed them tape. They showed them how they're going to use them, how this. And I think that's probably where a lot of it stemmed from too, is like, it's not that simple. We weren't just writing blank checks and that was our recruiting class.
Yeah, that's the discrepancy. Like you can show, you could be Mike Elko, and I talked to Mike Elko about like his defense and all the pieces he had on that defensive line last year. And that defensive line is the reason that they beat Bama. Like,
yeah,
the pressures that they had in that game and the way that they were able to mix things up and get home with only four was the way that they were able to beat Alabama. Way easier said than done, of course. Like you watched DeMarvin Leal, and you're like, yeah, that's a dude who does everything. He plays inside, he plays outside. It's the reason the Pittsburgh Steelers drafted him. But I think that this whole dynamic and why it could be different is the fact that it wasn't just that. It was also Jimbo pushing back and saying, like, you know, there's a reason, like, I've had opportunities to go back and work for him, and I haven't. Mm-hmm. Like, that feels different to come out and say something like that, basically saying, like, look, I worked for this guy. I know what's under the hood. I've seen the way that he operates. And for him to come out and accuse me of this, he's essentially saying, like, don't throw, you know, I think he said at one point, it's hard to keep track of everything they said, like, don't throw stones at a glass house, all those different things. But that to me felt like, okay, maybe there is a new wrinkle in this relationship, and it won't just be water on the bridge. So, like, it's one thing to be Lane Kiffin and to look into the CBS camera and say, get your popcorn ready, and then kind of have egg on your face and be able to laugh about it. Nobody is better at avoiding an L than Lane. And being able to kind of move on and make a joke of it. But Jimbo's not wired that way, because Jimbo's not also – isn't held to the same standard that Lane is. Jimbo was bought, whatever word you want to use.
Uh-oh.
See, I'm slipping up now.
You're like, you want this, Jimbo – you want the right? smoke from Jimbo now, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He was brought there and given that fake national championship plaque and said, look – This is the standard here, and that's the reason they did that. And ultimately, we're going to define Jimbo Fisher's tenure at Texas A&M by whether or not he can win an SEC championship, win a national championship. So it's just different. Jimbo is clearly under a different sort of microscope there. And to be called out by your former boss, I mean, if my former boss basically accused me of taking shortcuts, not of cheating, but of taking shortcuts to achieve success,
do you think that's what Nick was ultimately saying? I don't think Nick, if he could do it all over again, he could have thrown out another name. I think it was more pointed at just, here's what they're doing. It was almost like this, we have to do this or we're going to fall behind type deal. Where I don't think he was faulting Jimbo. I think he was just like, Jimbo's ahead of me and ahead of us here. And we have to fix this if you want to keep winning national championships. That was like it wasn't really a shot. It was more of like, this is what works now.
But the key word there is bought.
Yeah.
Because we're not at a place like collectively in college football where we can even process what that means. We've had decades of our brains telling us that saying that right there is accusing someone of cheating.
True.
And I think Jimbo Fisher is still wired that way. And that's why that defensive nature came out in such a public way. So yeah, is there a part of Nick Saban that is sitting there in front of all those business owners in Birmingham saying, look, we need to get on board with the NIL. We've got a collective. That was one of the things that he said. We've got 25 players who were able to make money off of this collective that had $3 million. There's a part of Nick Saban that is absolutely saying, look, let's make this happen for our guys. Let's make sure that they're well taken care of and all that. But I think the bigger thing that he was trying to point at, which Jimbo Fisher actually agrees with, they're both in agreement on this issue, is wanting to have this legislation, wanting to have some sort of guidelines to be able to say, this is legal, this is not legal, everybody is operating under the same rules. I don't think Nick Saban really wants to have to build his roster that way. And he brought up the point of having the guys who are guaranteed that money up front, and then for 3 years, they're not even playing yet. And he's like, well, that's a bad investment. I don't want to have to build up my roster that way. I don't want to have to listen or worry about if a booster, you know, has paid this player X amount of dollars and I feel a pressure to play them. I want to just be able to play the best players. And so I think that's part of it as well. But it was a multifaceted answer. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, that's going to come up regardless. But I think that's also come up just with smaller fees, basically. I think that was just something that's happened in college football 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Their boosters were involved. Like, read about college football in like the 70s, and like boosters having influence on roster decisions and who plays and who doesn't. That's been in college football for a long time. That is not something that's new in 2022. It's kind of like certain things in college football just come full circle, it feels like a little bit. In terms of the SEC East,
I'm curious from your perspective, now that the rosters are pretty settled now, Georgia obviously being the cream of the crop in the SEC, the top, I think they'll have a little bit of a drop off. Vegas sees a little bit of a drop, 10.5, where there is some wiggle room, where they see it could be Oregon, it could be the more likely option, Tennessee at home later in the season, it could be Florida, who knows. But Georgia's schedule is pretty easy. Like, Georgia's schedule, there's not a lot of landmines on it. And I actually made this point too with scheduling in the future of college football. If you're a Georgia fan, you should be pissed at what you're being get. Like, the Oregon game being a neutral site and losing a home game for that, and then this being your home calendar, the home schedule for Georgia fans is rough. Your number one game is Tennessee, and that's it. Like, Florida is a neutral site. Oregon's
every year.
Yeah, it's just rough. Like, and yeah, tickets are going up, man. Tickets aren't going down, and these fans are like, what are we paying for? That's a separate conversation. But I'm curious where you stand right now between the tier two. So tier one's Georgia. Tier two, I think, is, for me, tier two is Florida, Tennessee, Kentucky. Tier three is South Carolina, Mizzou. And then tier four is just the Vanderbilt Commodores, unfortunately. Shout out to Barton Simmons and Clark Lee. But I don't see the wins. Like, you go through that schedule and I don't see the wins. Is that the tiers that you have, or do you have it mixed up? How do you define tier two and tier three for you?
I would probably say that tier two is Tennessee and Kentucky.
Mm.
I think they're worthy of being in that spot. The offensive firepower that they should have this year, and of course it helps when you return a starting quarterback. But what they were able to do last year, and against, you know, good competition as well. I know Georgia was pretty much able to keep that Kentucky offense at bay. I joked that my doppelganger, Liam Cohen, him having two touchdowns in that game should have made him worthy of winning the Broyles Award. But still, I think that we look now at Kentucky and we say, well, what's next? I think Will Levis is going to take that next step. I think that him being a summer enrollee last year and playing as well as he did, especially in the latter half of the season, and then when they can finally cut him loose as a runner, that part of his game has shades of 2018 Joe Burrow, where Joe Burrow was a guy who they couldn't really cut loose from a running standpoint early in that year because Miles Brennan was the emergency quarterback as the backup and he was injured. They had all those depth issues at quarterback. They really didn't have much of an offensive line in 2018. And then when Burrow finally gets to run, he takes off like he did in the 7 overtime game against Texas A&M. Will Levis, same thing last year against Louisville. And look, like, I get why the buzz is there. He's got the velocity. He's got the toughness, the understanding of a pro style offense, which they incorporated last year. So there are a lot of things to like with Kentucky. I have questions about some of the pieces defensively that they're going to have to replace. I wonder about who the alpha is going to be without Josh Pascal and a couple of those different elements. But yeah, to me, I think Tennessee and Kentucky are worthy of being in that spot. The Hendon Hooker, Cedric Tillman connection, I'm sure you've talked about it a lot, should be one of the best in all of college football. I mean, it might have the highest floor of any individual connection in the SEC. It should be phenomenal. I mean, all Josh Heupel does is crank out top 10 offenses. I would expect that to be the case again this year. I would have loved to have seen Tyon Evans stay, but that's a different subject for a different time, man. But I still think they're going to be able to run the ball. Like, that's what they always do in that offense. So I'm of the belief that Kentucky and Tennessee are kind of in that tier two, and then tier three. You know, I have so many questions about South Carolina's offensive line. Are they going to be able to protect Spencer Rattler? Spencer Rattler put on about 12 pounds of muscle to try and be able to be a little bit more durable as a runner. He's going to take more hits than he did considering what he was playing behind at Oklahoma with those offensive linemen there. So, yeah, I think South Carolina is kind of in the next year. And then I just have a lot of questions about Florida. I think Florida defensively is going to be really bad. I think it's going to be rough year one. But Anthony Richardson, can he cut down on the mistakes? That's what Billy Napier has been able to do in the past. Are they able to get him some help in the running game as well and kind of establish that?
Montrell coming over from Louisiana.
Really like him, yeah.
Justin Shorter, is it the year? Like, if Justin Shorter finally pops at some point, then I don't know.
I'm not of that belief yet.
That's a problem. That's a problem. They brought in the Arizona State kid, too, who I don't know much about.
Yeah, the thing that they're going to be able to do really well is those RPO slants.
Yep.
That's going to be money in the bank. That's going to be their best passing play. And it's going to be, like, not to this level, but when Tua and Jalen Waddle used to just do that at will, and you'd be like, oh, that's a 75-yard touchdown. Boom, there you go. That's all you need. They're going to be able to do some of that this year, but of course, those are the high-percentage throws. I still need to see Anthony Richardson cut down on those mistakes. The LSU game, I always say, kind of encapsulated everything he is as a quarterback, where you see the upside, you see the downside. Let's see what it looks like week to week, not having to look over his shoulder with Emory Jones and not have to worry about a coach who's trying to save his job or anything like that. So, yeah, I have more questions about Florida and South Carolina. And then Mizzou, you know, we just talked about the quarterback situation before. Like, that's a big piece of this entire deal. Eli Drinkwitz is going to steal one. He's always going to steal one. But you can't put him in that next tier. So I would say he's probably – Mizzou's kind of in its own tier, and I would probably like tier four. And then South Carolina and Florida, I guess, are in that tier three range.
Yeah, I just – South Carolina's schedule is brutal. Like, you look at another just brutal schedule. Like, South Carolina, I think I pulled it up the other week. I think their last three games are Tennessee, Florida, and Clemson. Like, they – and I think people – it's recency bias, but people remember how you end far more than how you beat. Like, it doesn't matter what you did in September and October. It's like, how did you finish? Do you have some momentum? Because South Carolina, the momentum stuff was like, oh, they beat Florida late. They win the bowl game. There's all this momentum. Josh Heupel had to share a New Coach of the Year award with someone he beat 97-4 in Neyland that I was there for. Not that I'm still thinking about that a little bit. South Carolina fans are, they're excited and they're up. And I'm just like, I don't know. I think if you make a bowl this year, if you're South Carolina, this is a successful season, because this season is like anything more than six wins. Shane Beamer, build the statue, because this is rough. Like, South Carolina fans think South Carolina is what Kentucky is. And Kentucky, I think, is in this own tier where Kentucky's got a high floor. Like, out of all the tier two teams or the teams below Georgia, if I had to bet, like, the highest floor, it's South Carolina, or it's Kentucky. Tennessee, you could maybe say just because of the offense, but the defense can be bad. You talk about a bad defense in Florida. Tennessee secondary is just, I mean, Flowers and McCullough will be back at safety spots, but the corner depth is non-existent, and they have... there's so much being asked of Tyler Barron and Byron Young on the edge that, like, they can't get a breather, or you just can't.
Can you ever in that defense, though? Like, that's the knock against Heupel coming in.
Well, you want, like, four guys. We can rotate a little bit. We want some rotation there, and we just don't have guys to rotate in.
One of the guys who is going to be most missed in the entire SEC that I'm not sure was talked about enough last year is Matthew Butler.
Yeah.
Having a guy who can play as much as he did and be as – in shape as he was to play that snap count, to me, was one of the big reasons why Tennessee surpassed my very low expectations. I said Tennessee, from a defensive standpoint, that is, I said Tennessee was going to have the worst defense in the SEC last year, and I was wrong. And Tim Banks absolutely proved me wrong. And I think having a guy
who was worse last year,
Last year would have been
Mizzou, right?
I think Mizzou ended up being worse, although they actually had a much better November. And then, because it wasn't like Ole Miss was just was perfectly fine. Vandy was obviously worse.
Yeah.
I'd have to go back through and figure that out, because
no one else pops off the page. I'm trying. I guess LSU had to be pretty bad last year.
Yeah, LSU was still pretty. Although they figured things out in the last month of the year. That's kind of what a lot of these teams did. So yeah, I'm setting those expectations really low. But at the same time, it's like, well, in this era of college football, you can kind of have a bad defense and still be 8-4, still be 9-3, still kind of mess around and have some fun. So, I think that those questions on the defensive side for Tennessee are real. And not having Alante Taylor, who just developed into just a phenomenal guy who came in playing on the other side of the ball, and, you know, say what you want about Jeremy Pruitt, but kind of getting that guy to buy into playing corner and doing those things that he did early in his tenure, I thought paid dividends for them last year.
I'm excited. We'll see what happens, though. I'm ready. I'm not going to say that. I'm not ready for the season. You know what I'm ready for? Hoover SEC Championship Baseball, where the Tennessee Volunteers, I don't think, are even going to play because of the delay. So everything's behind. So Tennessee, I think if they played today, it would play Vandy. It would be like 11 midnight near. I don't think that's going to happen.
Can I ask you a question? You know Tennessee baseball more than I do, and I've kind of wondering about this. And I was talking to Dari Noka about this subject. Could there be an SEC football version of what Tennessee baseball has become in this modern era, with all the scrutiny on social media, with the way that the game is officiated from a defensive standpoint, with some of the it's not the mid-90s with the way that safeties are allowed to play mm-hmm. and the headhunting and all those different things. Could there actually be an SEC football version of what Tennessee baseball has become?
I mean, Kiffin tries to do that at Ole Miss a little bit, but they don't have the firepower. It's just it's like if you had Kiffin's brand at Alabama, maybe, but I don't know. It's just it's so volatile, and I don't think so. It's also just like the amount of games. So it's like part of the appeal with Tennessee is when you just like, oh, they won another series. Oh, they swept another team. It's so helpless to watch these opposing fan bases come into Lindsey Nelson and just game one versus game two. And then the game three vibe where it's like, we just want to get out of here. We're tired of these home runs, where it's just baseball is a longer ordeal. You're having to sit there and there's not a lot of action for a little bit of time. And then there's just a bunch of action at once. And then there is just the game gets away from you. Like the Mississippi State game, the first one last week, they had three home runs in the first top of the first inning, and it was over. The game was over in the top of the first inning. So could that happen in college football season? But it's also like we're coming off the diamond just with the leopard print over our shoulders and like just fully embracing that villain type thing. But I think that's unique to baseball, to college baseball. I don't think that would translate. I just don't think it would translate. But I also am concerned because you talked about the AP number one, the preseason to win national titles. There has not been a number one overall seed that's won the College World Series since like 99 with Miami. Yeah. So that's something that's concerning for Tennessee.
Being too good. Being too good. It must be nice.
Yeah. I mean, but it's one of those things. Baseball's weird, man. Baseball's a weird sport. It's College World Series, regionals. It can get weird. Like we got a crazy regional last year with Wright State, who was just this great, not group of five, but you know, the same kind of thing. And it took a Grand Slam walk off in the bottom of the ninth to survive that and make it to Omaha. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just fun. Like it's just, with how Tennessee football has been for a long time and to see this baseball team just kind of be the Fulmers of the late 90s where we're just bigger and better than you, because that's kind of what it is with the John Hendersons of the world and the Al Wilsons, where Jordan Beck is a gigantic human being and Drew Gilbert's just all muscle and we're throwing heat. We have Ben Joyce out here throwing 104. He sets the college baseball record or baseball in general record for his heat. Like that kind of thing where it's just the power is kind of reminds me of the Fulmer years where it's just Jamal Lewis and we're going to run it down your throat and you're not going to be able to do anything about it. Like this is going to be uncomfortable and awkward and just awful for you, but you're going to take your medicine. You're going to eat your vegetables. And that's how it's going to be. And that's what this Tennessee baseball season is. That's why I'm going to Omaha. Like I'll never see a Tennessee baseball team like this ever again in my life. Like this is all the stars aligned. It's not sustainable. People would get extremely annoyed. There will be a lot more hit by pitches next year if this is what we're doing year over year. But hey, when you're in everything school, Connor, it's just part of the deal. It just means more down here. What else can I say?
Have you been to Omaha for the College World Series?
No,
it's fun.
So you've been?
Yeah, I actually worked out in Nebraska for 2.5 years out of college.
Nice. And so it's worth it.
Yeah, I think so. And I went to see 2013 Indiana, that team that had Schwarber on it. And I'm a Cubs fan too, in case you can't tell.
Yeah.
So like Schwarber was my guy. And the fact that like they were able to get there, I got to see him win. It was like a 1-0 game. It was before they kind of revamped the dimensions and whatnot that they had there. And every game was just like, oh crap, nobody's gonna hit one out in this ballpark. And but it was still like a really cool atmosphere. Omaha kind of embraces it. And I always advocate for it. I think Omaha, like I love kind of those like small, like not overly intense downtowns like in Omaha. Mm-hmm. I love Indianapolis. I've been a very big advocate of like a Charlotte or places like that. So I think Omaha is kind of a little bit of a hidden gem, and going there for the College World Series and just kind of seeing the fanfare and the way that people embrace it for, you know, for that week. It's just kind of a unique experience that we don't really get anything quite like that, where you just have like fans show up and they just want to buy random gear and find a team. And they like just jump on a bandwagon because they love the College World Series. Tennessee will be an interesting test if they can get there, of what that dynamic would be like if they're going to have gear flying off the shelves, if they're going to be kind of, embraced as like, you know, the late 80s Pistons, these bad boys, or if it's going to be a little bit of this different stay away, they're bad for the sport, or that those think pieces will be coming, probably coming to Saturday Night South real soon.
Well, hold on, Connor, you have control over this. You can limit those. You can just you can send them out. You can just say, no, we're not doing that. We're not doing
that. I don't have that much control, man. Like, I don't know if you've gone to, if you've got, you go on the homepage right now, like we've got so, like I say all the time, we've got so much content on there. Like, yeah. I can't control if my guy Joe Cox is going to write a Tennessee think piece. I can't control what Adam Spencer's going to write. Like, you know, my colleagues, they do great work. They come up with their own opinions. If that stuff is floated out there, then you know what? So be it. And that's the brand. That's the way we do business. But yeah, there'll be a lot of opinions about Tennessee baseball the deeper they last into the postseason, for sure.
I mean, Twitter's going to explode if they don't win in Omaha, or if they lose in the regionals or something like that. Like, it's just going to be nonstop, just takes on takes on takes. And just like, oh, this, see what happens when you play this way and you run your mouth and you do this is what happened. It's like, or we just caught a bad break and we went cold at the wrong possible time. Maybe that's not like this full-on indictment on our culture here at UT. Maybe
so it's stupid. Like, it almost goes back to like the Michigan Fab Five stuff, where people, like, when they would lose and then like they lost the national championship, it's like, oh, see, if they had been more focused on like playing quality defense instead of playing, you know, wearing baggy shorts, it's like did you listen to yourself just say that? Like, you really think that was a contributing factor as to why this team didn't win a national championship? Like,
and they're a second away from winning a national championship. So it's like, if that 1 second goes differently, if the timeout situation goes, it's so silly the way, like, a lot of us just look at sports is so silly. It's result driven and all that kind of stuff, but it's fun. It's leading to expansion that Knoxville's standing room only most of the time. Like, it's wild to be at a college baseball game, standing room only, and just people are dying to see it, and it's a lot of fun. Dingers in college just mean more because the sound of the metal bat is a lot more fun. You just it's a wild experience. 3-4-5 Beck, Gilbert, and Lipscomb, what are you gonna do? What are you gonna do with that 3-4-5 spot? I don't know, Connor. I don't know.
My brother played college baseball at Valparaiso, and so I used to go to his games a good amount, and you know, especially like if they played at Butler or something like that, I drive up north in Indianapolis when I was in college at Indiana, and like seeing the college baseball experience there compared to what some of these SEC programs have become, you know, Tennessee, obviously everybody was talking about Mississippi State last year, you know, Ole Miss, these great atmospheres, like that to me is just, it's a different world, and I need to experience more of it because it looks like just one of the best tickets you can possibly get in sports right now. I mean, like that to me is just such a different sort of experience than when I came to grow up and expect as it relates to college baseball. But I remember my brother going down to play, you know, at Arkansas, like, you know, would have been what, like 12 years ago, 13 years ago or something like that. And just coming back being like, yo, the SEC is different, man. It's just different.
When you go back home though, do you feel more Southern now at this point, Connor? Do you feel Southern these days? Or are you a Northerner? What are you?
I don't really identify as much because like I've lived in like so many different parts of the country.
Yeah.
I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, went to college in Indiana, went out to Nebraska. I worked at Baseball Hall of Fame as an intern there for like 3 months. I lived in upstate New York. Like I feel like I've seen and I've traveled to different places and have experienced a lot. And so when I'll go back home and I'll drop like a y'all in casual conversation, I'll kind of go, like, what are you doing? And there's a part of Southern culture like that you just kind of want to embrace and be a part of. And I'm the person, like, I want to try all the foods. I grew up with collard greens. I want to be able to eat collard greens. I want to be able to have, you know, whatever tailgate food is available when I go to Louisiana. Like, I'm in Baton Rouge. So yeah, I kind of identify as like a Midwesterner who has really embraced the South. And to be fair, I live in Orlando, man. Like it's not really the South. There's a bubble over here. It's just a bubble over the entire city. I don't live.
I was going to say, I wouldn't call Orlando the South.
It's not. It's not.
Gainesville's the South. Gainesville and Tallahassee are the South. They qualify. But anything past that.
You got to go north to get to the South. Yeah, I love Gainesville.
Isn't that weird? Yeah, you got to go north to get to the South.
It's weird.
Yeah, no, South Georgia and North Florida are the exact same. They're just they could be their own state, like South Georgia, like, because then the people who are like, oh well, Atlanta, where I'm from, is very, very different than just about anywhere an hour outside of Atlanta. It's just different. Connor Gara, thank you so much for making the time. I greatly appreciate it. What can the good folks check out from you? You had a good piece on Sankey in the playoff from today that I read. So check that out, but also all the other great stuff at SaturdayDownSouth.com. Your podcast, Texas Pete, still running strong, still putting it on everything. You like that?
I Texas Pete every morning, man. Who doesn't?
I put Texas Pete on my eggs every morning. I really do.
Have to. Same.
They're great.
Way to do it. Yeah, it's the best. Whenever somebody's like, oh, I'm like debating having another hot sauce, I'm like, well, is just grocery store out of Texas Pete? Like, what are you doing that for? That seems silly. Yeah,
I don't know. There you go. I love learning about stuff from ads. Like Matt Wyatt and Starkville, friend of the pod, has a really good show. He has Country Pleasin', and he talked about it all the time. And then Country Pleasin' popped up in my local Kroger, and I was like, done. I already am sold. And it's the best sausage I've ever had. Like, I'll never go back. Like, I'm a big sausage guy. And it's fantastic. It's hey, authentic brand connections are a good thing.
They are. Yeah, that's what we try and do with Texas Pete. Saturday on South Podcast, still presented by Texas Pete. But, yeah, we put that, like, on eggs, on sandwiches, chicken, whatever. Just makes any meal better. I didn't think I'd be plugging Texas Pete today, but you know, here we go.
I got you. Connor Gara, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it, and we'll have to check back in again soon.
Awesome. Appreciate it, man.
All right, that's a wrap for part one with Connor Gara of Saturday Down South here on the Chase Owens Podcast. Thank you again to Connor for coming on the show. Hope you guys enjoyed Connor and I's conversation on all things SEC and CFB. That's not the only college football that you're going to hear on this one. Oh, yeah, it's Thursday, so that means the full ride with Matt Green's coming up too. Look out for that in just 1 second. But part two of the Thursday May 26th edition here on the Chase Owens Podcast coming up right for this on this podcast feed. So look out for that. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure that you leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Helps other people find the show, and it helps this show continue to grow. Check us out on YouTube, youtube.com, type in the Chase Owens Podcast, subscribe, like, share out our videos, all that good stuff. New episode coming up in just 1 second. Derek, how'd I do?
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.